Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So could the president shoot Jim Comey and still not be prosecuted? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. That's what Rudy Giuliani said.
Yeah, to the Huffington Post, this after he made the rounds on the Sunday morning television programs. He made that bizarre hypothetical. That's what I'm calling it, the hypothetical.
So here's the thing. I understand the need to illustrate a legal argument, their legal argument. As part of explaining this 20-page memo that Trump's legal team delivered.
I thought it was leaked.
Well, it's just such an odd illustration to choose because, I mean, it really undermines this notion that we're a nation of laws, not men, and all of those men are and women, you know what I mean, are equal under that
okay.
law. So it's just an odd way to say it. I just don't like that explanation. There's a number of things. I don't know if Giuliani is the best right. mouthpiece for making the arguments that are contained in that 20-page memo or just generally making the argument on behalf of the president.
The only one who can defend President Trump is Kellyanne Conway. I thought about it while I was watching Giuliani just make a mess of things all over the networks and cable TV shows. They bring back Kellyanne Conway. I mean, I know she's not a lawyer, but he wasn't really, you know, this Giuliani doesn't seem like a legal expert, a brilliant mind in the matter of law. So why not just bring back a spokesperson who knows how to defend him?
I don't know about his with respect to where his mind is in legal knowledge or expertise or strategy.
But you as an attorney would never make a hypothetical of if he shot James Comey in the middle of the street.
Yeah, I don't know why Trump and his friends continue to use this I could shoot somebody illustration. I could shoot somebody on Madison Avenue?
This is what he said. It was in Sioux City, Iowa, back in 2016.
The people, my people are so smart. And you know what else they say about my people? The polls. They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
Yeah, okay,
it's like incredible.
I just don't know why that metaphor is used over and over again. So anyway, Giuliani saying, you know, you picking up on Trump's campaign rhetoric of how loyalist people are. And this is how much power the president has.
How much power does he have?
But the more interesting thing is whether or not he's going to sit for an interview, whether or not he's going to comply if he were subpoenaed. And Giuliani made it clear that they would fight it.
Do you and the president's attorneys believe the president has the power to pardon himself?
He's not, but he probably does. I mean, he has no intention of pardoning himself, but he probably does. It doesn't say he can't. I mean, that's another really interesting constitutional argument. Can the president pardon himself?
I think it's an open question?
I used to run the pardon attorney. It would be an open question. I think it would probably get answered by, gosh, that's what the Constitution says, and if you want to change it, change it. But, yeah. In addition to the constitutional issue, which will be, you know, a complex one, we admit that, although we think we have the better argument, the one that's definitive is the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, wrote a memo at the conclusion of the Clinton thing and the Clinton administration and said you cannot indict a sitting president, nor can you compel process. So it's part of the rules of the Justice Department. And Mueller is
has
nothing.
Has he responded to the letter?
Has not.
No response
right.
to the letter.
And Mueller is completely surrounded by the rules of the Justice Department and agreed to follow them.
Right. So, I mean, there's a couple of things there, right? One, him talking about whether or not Trump could pardon himself. And again, the question, why would he need to? If nothing,
if there's no there, there's no collusion.
If he hasn't done anything wrong, then why would he need to pardon himself? This is where I don't understand Giuliani's communication again. So he could shoot Jim Comey, and also he could potentially pardon himself. It's an interesting legal question. Why would you even open up that question? Why wouldn't you say to Stephanopoulos, I don't know, it's an interesting legal question. It's irrelevant here because the president doesn't need to pardon himself because there's nothing to pardon himself over because he hasn't done anything wrong.
See, that is the best answer. And Chris Christie went on to say on This Week Later, saying, well, if the president pardons himself, then he will be impeached. There's no question.
Well,
the fact that it was even brought up in the first place is very odd. And then I just think he got tired at the end of the day and just started spouting off like, oh, he could shoot James Comey in the middle of the street.
Well, again, this 20-page letter that was sent to Robert Mueller.
And then how somehow landed in the hands of the New York Times.
As happens. I mean, there's a lot of argument or a lot of speculation, I should say, that despite all of the suggestion that Mueller runs a tight ship, no leaks on USS Mueller, that Andrew Weissman and others that are more politically minded, arguably, are actually talking to the press, are actually leaking information. This was a 20-page letter that was sent to Mueller back in January, and it contended, among other things, that the president cannot illegally obstruct the probe into Russian election meddling because he has the power to terminate the inquiry, or even, as Giuliani argued, the power to pardon. Now, certainly, he does have, unarguably, power over the executive branch. And I thought Rich Lowry made a good point about this memo in National Review. Can you commit, and this is the same thing that Dershowitz has said, too, can you commit obstruction of justice when you're exercising your lawful powers? And the argument is, well, maybe if you're exercising them as part of a cover-up for unlawful ends, but then you wouldn't be, that would be outside the scope of your lawful powers. I don't know. It gets into a bit of semantics. But he actually goes to the memo, the argument that they make here, and reminds Mueller, does Trump's lawyers, of what Mueller said, of what Comey said, and of what the president said. In the memo, even if we were to ignore the White House's version of events and take Comey's understanding at face value, Mr. Comey did not confront the president, nor did he report the attempted obstruction, quote unquote. He did not let this go, and he received no further communication from the president or any other person from the White House on the matter. This is regarding the, you know, let this Michael Flynn thing go.
Oh, okay.
He didn't let it go. He didn't report attempted obstruction. There was no communication, no additional communication between the president and Comey on the matter. So where's the obstruction? Mr. Comey made it clear a couple of times that number one, they were not personally investigating the president. That's what he told President Trump in their March 30th meeting, 2017 phone call, not personally investigating the president. And that after all of this, for at least a time, his relationship was fine. The New York Times reported following that March 30, 2017 call, Comey said, quote, his relationship with the president and the White House staff was now in the right place. I think we've kind of got them trained. On March 8th of 2017, Comey told an audience at the cybersecurity conference, you're stuck with me for another 6.5 years. And Trump's lawyers argue that, he indicated he expected to serve the remainder of his 10-year time, which belies any sentiment that he was suffering under the pressure of a presidential directive he was refusing to execute. So that's Comey. Then they go and recall, remember the interview that Trump did with Lester Holt, the sit-down he did?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, they kind of talked over each other when it was the issue of firing Comey. Why'd you do it? But remember the president said, I'm just going to read the part of the transcript here. As far as I'm concerned, I want the Russian investigation, to be absolutely done properly. When I did this now, firing Comey, I said, I probably maybe will confuse people. Maybe I'll expand that, you know, I'll lengthen the time because it should be over with. It should be, in my opinion, should have been over with a long time ago because it's all an excuse. But I said to myself, I might even lengthen out the investigation, but I have to do the right thing for the American people. He's the wrong man for that position. So Lowry concludes, you know, is Trump maybe guilty of impure thoughts? about the Russian investigation? Maybe. But that's not a crime, and it shouldn't be a central element of a wide-ranging special counsel investigation. And that's why, you know, frankly, I don't know if it really serves Mueller's interest to have this memo leaked, because it just recounts what Comey said, what Trump said, how things were after this alleged, you know, let it go possible evidence of obstruction. And so, you know, where does the evidence come together for any kind of obstruction charge or even any kind of basis for an impeachment proceeding? It's just it's difficult to make out. The more that you look at this case, including where individuals have been charged, like the Papadopoulos case, the flimsier Mueller's work product looks at this juncture.
Yeah, he looks desperate. Like he's grabbing his straws.
So that's why, like the Giuliani thing, I understand they think they're in a strong position. And based on what we know that's public, it seems like they are. But I just don't. Then why would you get into the business of whether or not the president can pardon himself? Why would you? He could shoot Jim Comey. Basically, look, this is a guy who did nothing wrong. This is an investigation that hasn't produced any evidence of any wrongdoing at a senior level or any wrongdoing even with the Russians as it pertains to the Trump campaign. We're more than a year in. And so, you know, it's put up or shut up time for Mueller. That seems to me a better argument to make. Chris in Aurora, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, I'm looking at this more from like a bunch of men sitting at a table playing poker, and they're, I guess, indicating how strong their hand is versus it being more of a legal matter and them saying legally they can do this or constitutionally I can do that. What they're doing is they're using media and us as the audience to kind of posture themselves with their hand. And that's what I believe Giuliani's words were, basically was saying, we could do this and get away with it, signaling to Mueller that, you know, basically you're going up a wrong tree here. You might as well back off because this is what we're willing to do or how far we're willing to take it. Now, that could be a bluff on their side, too. I don't know. But I think this is more just political posturing than it is anything.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But here's the thing. Why take that posture exactly? I mean, you can communicate that we're not going to comply with a subpoena. We're going to fight it. We think we have the better constitutional argument. You've got nothing, Mueller, without coming across as so imperious. You know what I mean?
See, but the reason why, Dan, I think they're doing that is because there's a lot of people, you'd have to admit this too, that are ignorant in regards to what exactly we're dealing with here. I mean, some people don't know the first line of the Constitution, let alone deep into it and what it says. So I think what they're doing is using words to kind of like corral the audience here to say, okay, this is what we could do because we can do it. And on a Mueller side, I think what this is just a matter of Mueller side running the clock out. He wants this to go as far as he can to closest to November. So that way people go into the polls thinking, well, there's this whole looming thing going on with Trump and this investigation. Maybe I shouldn't vote for him. I think that's all that is on their side, is to try to continue to keep this narrative alive, even though it's nothing there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then on the other side, you have Giuliani and them basically continuing to say, we could do this, we could do that. And then now you're trapped with, okay, there's hardcore people that are going to vote one way for Trump. There's hardcore people that are going to vote the other way for the left. And then there's this small sliver in the middle that doesn't understand or doesn't keep up with the topics. And that's what the battle's over. That small sliver in the middle going, okay, when they go in there to pull the lever for whoever they're going to vote for, whoever was able to win this show that we're watching every day on TV, Evolve, that's who's going to be the next president. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Chris. Yeah, I mean, I get the argument that you're making. I just don't know how many more graphic metaphors we're going to have to endure between now and November. President Trump could dismember Jim Comey and dump the body in the Hudson Bay, and we're still not going to comply with a subpoena.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And as Mike Scott reported, Governor Rauner set to sign yet another phony baloney budget. That's what we do in Illinois, that they claim is balanced, and they'll celebrate the bipartisan nature of it and how they all came together to do this wonderful thing of spending $1 billion more plus than we spent last year, despite the fact that we have $250 million in debt.
Did you see Jim Durkin's interview on Friday? He said he's like, I'm almost in tears. I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah.
Oh my God, stop, pull up your big boy pants and wipe your tears.
They're so proud of themselves.
I mean, seriously, patting themselves, the self-adulation was just disgusting.
So among other things in the budget, I mean, it's all, you know, it's not all, but a lot of it is gimmickry. Again, have not had a truly balanced budget in this state since 2001. And you wonder why we are where we are, but don't change out the political leadership of either party. Please don't do that. Let's keep this up. So, for example, they sell the Thompson Center 3 times. They just keep selling it over and over again to generate the necessary revenue they need to close the budget gap in terms of how much they want to spend versus how much revenue is anticipated by the relevant agencies, the green eye shades guys that calculate this. Also, the spending plan relies on as much, almost $500 million in pension savings. With
how are they doing that?
With buyouts.
Oh.
But the problem is the buyouts for tier one pensioners are voluntary. So you're asking state workers to voluntarily cut their pension.
Who? Please raise your hand if you'd like us to cut your pension. We need volunteers. Move to the front of the line.
Yeah, I mean, those are just a couple of examples. Oh, here's something else.
Well, what's in it for them?
What's in it for who?
The people that want to take a cut in their pension.
Well, you'd argue that, well, this is a way to, net present value, take a lump sum.
Right.
And this is a way to ensure that you get,
get paid because other people down the line might not get paid.
That, you know, a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. But yeah, more out of, you know, concern about how long is this house of cards going to stay up, and so maybe I should take the money and run. Difficult to calculate that. Also, there's this that's in the budget. $172 million towards construction of the Obama Center or library or whatever the hell it's called, being built in Chicago. $172 million.
I thought that was all going to be donated, the money to build that.
Construction and maintenance will be funded by private donations and no taxpayer money will go to the foundation. Quote, unquote, that's what an Obama Foundation spokesperson had said.
Yeah, they've been telling that us since day one when they were choosing sites. Remember, it was going to be either here or in New York, possibly Hawaii.
$172 million of our money, is that the least of what we owe President Obama? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I don't want to give a dime to that museum. I'll give money to that museum when I go see it and I pay an entrance fee.
I'll give a dime to it when I understand exactly what it is. Well, is it a center? Is it a museum? Is it a library? Is it a
golf course?
Kids park?
Is it a,
is it a golf
course? They're building a golf course next to it that I think Tiger Woods is going to help design.
Uh-huh.
And then there's grass on the roof, which is weird, and trees.
Sure. Is
it seems to be eco-friendly.
Is it a solar farm? Is it a wind farm? What
well,
is it?
It's a bike trail, and then there's hoops, and then there's a golf course, and then there's...
Is it a Turkish bathhouse? I want to understand what it
there
is.
There is a sauna in the basement. No, it's a museum. It's a complex.
Oh, it's a complex now.
That's what I heard. It's the President Obama Presidential Library and Complex.
And museum.
Midnight basketball, huh? Sign up your teams now. 312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line.
Grant in Rockford, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, you guys. Listen, I'm a young state employee, and I'm ashamed to admit it, but 30 years old, I'd take a pension buyout right now if they'd stop stealing from my check for the next 20 years that says I will not have to pay into all these other people. As far as the Obama complex concerned,
you're tier two.
It's complicated.
You're tier, Grant, you're tier two,
what's
right?
That, Dan?
You're a tier two employee then?
Tier one, I believe, rule
oh,
of 85, whatever that
oh,
means.
Okay.
It combines years of service with age, and it's pretty convoluted, and I try to stay out of it. I do my own thing and set aside my own money because I don't trust these snakes as far as I can throw them.
That is smart.
But
yes.
So yeah, as far as I'm concerned, the Obama complex, it's complicated, but it's plush fun to line the pockets of everybody except the people that live in the area. So you guys have a good morning. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for the call, Grant.
I mean, I'm looking forward to a new museum in the city. We've been to every place you could possibly go.
Is it going to be like the East Bank Club, or what is it going to be? Is it like a multiplex? Are there going to be pickleball courts? That's what I want to know. Dave and Racine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I was just wondering, where's Chance the Rapper? He seems to object to spending money on a police training facility that would actually help save lives by, you know, improve training of police. But the idea of having, you know, a shrine to Barack Obama, who, if the stuff about his domestic surveillance and tyrannical activities, you know, it's supporting someone who's, you know, not really that worthy.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Dave. Chance the Rapper, he brings that up. Well, that's sort of one argument that one could make if we weren't indebted to Barack Obama, so the force of taking our money seems more appropriate. And that is $172 million. You don't think Obama could raise that money from his Hollywood friends?
Of course he can. Wait, I feel insulted because I have been lied to. They have told us since day one that this is not going to cost any taxpayer money.
But remember,
to build it.
Yeah, well, that's, you're right.
Well, to build it, but then what's $172 million for? To maintain it, to
the construction and maintenance. Yeah, this is towards construction. $172 million towards construction is how it's indicated.
Oh my gosh, President Obama, Michelle, they could produce more on Netflix, please. Start getting films, more documentaries.
Well,
they have big galas, raise the money that way.
Well, here's the thing, though, you have to remember, you're not factoring this in, and this is an interesting column from Maureen Dowd, considering it's a column by Maureen Dowd, reminding us that President Obama is too good for us, or at least he thinks he is. This new book from Ben Rhodes, mm-hmm. you know, the guy who talked about how he was the puppet master for all of the D.C. press corps marionettes, creating that echo chamber on the Iran deal and other matters. Ben Rhodes, National Security.
Isn't his brother in charge of CBS News?
Yes, David.
No,
sure,
David Rhodes.
Exactly.
Okay.
They don't talk, though, so, you know, don't worry about any
conflict. Okay. Yeah.
In terms of coverage. Dowd writes, as President Obama always found us wanting, we were constantly disappointing him. He would tell us the right thing to do and then sigh and purse his lips when instructions were not followed. Shortly after Trump was elected, Rhodes writes in his new book, The World as It Is, that's the name of the book, Obama asked his aides, what if we were wrong? So you think, oh, this is Obama with a moment of self-doubt. No. In the next breath, the president made clear that what he meant is, what if we were wrong in being so right? What if we were too good for these people? Maybe we push too far, President Obama continued. Maybe people just want to fall back into their tribe. Sometimes I wonder whether I was 10 or 20 years too early. Future man got here too early for us.
Oh.
You see. So evolved is Obama that it would have been better had he come 10 or 20 years later when we were enlightened enough to understand his greatness.
Yeah.
We failed him.
Yes, we did.
And thus, $172 million for the people of Illinois, from the people of Illinois, seems
so ridiculous. Pay for it yourself, you snob.
Paula in Glendale Heights.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Good.
No, I just wanted to make a comment about the pension. I myself have worked for the state for 22 years. Mm-hmm. I love what I do, and I love working for the state. But it makes me a little sick when I think to myself that the people of Illinois are going to have to be paying for me until I'm, you know, old and dead. I would much rather buy my pension out and it's on me. You know what I'm saying? Like, let me handle my money.
Yeah, that's no. All. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, thanks for the call, Paul. Right. You probably don't want it at 60 cents on the dollar, though. Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Look, you guys are missing a real obvious point here. Mm-hmm. If I remember right, the facility is going to be built on Park District land, which means they're going to need Park District people to work there and then city people to supervise them and then the state to oversee everything. So we're going to have a few thousand people working there who we have to generate more pensions for. So obviously they need more money.
That's an economic boon is what you're saying. You know, you're going to have
all that public. Well, if you're on the political side.
Yeah, thanks for the color. All that public sector employment.
Everyone's from all over the world is going to come to Chicago to go to the Obama Presidential Library Center.
Complex museum.
Complex museum, golf course, sauna.
Right, pool and tennis club.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
You know, I think the grass on the roof that you were talking about.
Yeah, that people might frolic on but don't fall off.
I think that's for the Chum Gang.
Oh, the
Paul in New Lenox, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, guys. Just two quick questions. I was wondering, is the Nobel Peace Prize that Obama got, is that going to be the focal point of the library? Or can we still get, like, the Star Wars Museum in place that would actually generate revenue?
Yeah, good question. Thanks for the call,
Star
Paul.
Star Wars Museum has already been built and is up and running in Los Angeles, which is a perfect place for it.
You're such a Star Wars nerd.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and it's time to do a bit of an intervention on Amy.
Oh, no.
Per the education of what have become to be both of, you know, all of our sons, Peyton and Eli.
Yes.
Your sons are our sons.
Exactly.
They're the show's sons. They're Salem property.
Exactly. And they've been on the air here during the strike. They did a commercial. They've helped out. They've done
Scabs.
Some voiceover work. No, no.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Thank
we brought them in during the fifth day of the strike. I think that was 2010. When was that? When did we go on strike? I can't remember.
I don't know. I wouldn't.
Because I was so bored. I'm like, you're coming to work with me.
This study out from the Thomas Fordham Institute by UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara,
The banana slugs. No,
that's Santa Cruz.
I have a cousin at UC Santa Cruz and UC Santa Barbara.
Come on.
They're the water moccasins.
No. that would be interesting. That'd be a unique nickname. The Gauchos. UC Santa Barbara Gauchos.
Gauchos? I wore those in the 70s.
Wait,
what's a gaucho?
You're going to have to Google it.
Oh, here we go. I got to Google.
It's the only way you're going to learn.
Gauchos.
The Fordham Institute and University of California, Santa Barbara Associate Professor Michael Gottfried, along with a couple of doctoral students.
It shows a pair of pants.
Yeah.
Gauchos.
It's like a cowboy.
Oh.
Okay.
Excuse me. Go on with your story.
The academics looked at two waves of national data on elementary school students collected under the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study for the National Center for Education Statistics, which I know you've read.
Of course. I put the copy back on your desk.
Thank you. I hope you didn't smudge my margin notes.
I didn't.
They compared children in Catholic schools with those in public schools and other private schools, religious and secular.
And
we're going to talk about the Catholic school difference, and we'll take your calls to encourage Amy to allow me to set up a GoFundMe page to fund the Peyton and Eli Catholic school education.
To Paul Prep.
The authors found statistically meaningful evidence that students in Catholic schools exhibited less disruptive behavior than their counterparts in other schools. Boy, this is an interesting topic, too, given the backdrop of school shootings and violence at the K-12 level. So there's, you know, sort of a...
Did you hear what happened on Friday?
More salient aspect to this than normal.
On Friday, a student from Lane Tech, 14-year-old girl, grabbed her dad's assault rifle, took a picture and said, "Don't worry, I won't bring it to Lane." And he got in trouble. He's a Chicago firefighter. He got charged because he didn't properly store the weapon to keep it away from other people in the family.
Well, here's the results of this study. Catholic school children argued, fought, got angry, acted impulsively, and disturbed ongoing activities less frequently. Now, the authors concede their findings are not causal, for all of you econometricians out there. So there may be unobservable differences between students in different schools that account for striking difference they found. But the correlation is strong between the focus that Catholic schools put on self-discipline and better student behavior, also importantly, especially in urban areas. Black and Latino students who attend Catholic schools show higher achievement and higher graduation rates and higher college enrollment than those at nearby public schools, which is certainly the case in Chicago. It's the Monsignor Michael Boland formulation. We don't educate children because they're Catholic. We educate children because we're Catholic. So the authors of this study offer three key judgments. Schools that value and focus on self-discipline will likely do a better job of fostering it in children. Catholic schools tend to take discipline pretty seriously, and they have the stick to impose it. And so the children are better disciplined.
So do they still?
Seems logical.
Do nuns still walk around with a ruler?
I think that's a relic of a bygone era.
I don't think so either. I was kidding.
But perhaps they should around public schools. Dispatch like tactical teams of nuns to some of these public schools. They'll shape it right up.
I'll never forget the Catholic schools in El Paso, Texas, used to slap kids on the wrist if they spoke Spanish. Because I had a lot of Hispanic friends there that didn't speak any Spanish. And I was wondering, why wouldn't, I mean, if you grew up with your parents speaking Spanish, why wouldn't you? Like, nope, Catholic nuns would smack our wrists if we were speaking Spanish. Had to speak English.
Well,
I'm like, okay. That's an ancillary issue, but just.
The only way you're going to learn the King's English. So you've got the self-discipline is one takeaway. Second, other schools might consider both explicit and implicit methods to replicate this Catholic schools effect, they're terming it. No excuses, charter schools are already doing this. Through the curriculum or the way students interact with adults and teachers who model self-discipline themselves. A good example of this would be urban prep academies in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Tim King's operation.
I know.
It's for black men, young men, of course, suited up, ties.
Every day.
You know, I've gone to their little poker tournament fundraiser
the last
few years.
I'm the one who brought you.
Yeah.
Or suggested you.
And I mean, you know, these kids are killers.
I meet them at East Bank Club. They always take a tour, and that, you know, like any questions you have, and they'll converse with you.
Well, they're
engaged. They care.
They're squared away. They're going on to college. A lot of good schools are coming back and helping the next generation of kids behind them. I mean, so it's an impressive operation. So this is what the authors of the study are talking about.
Do you think now that I got Peyton's DNA test and he's 28% African, I could call Tim King?
No. Third, don't underestimate the power of religion to positively influence a child's behavior. Religion isn't the only way to foster self-discipline, but it is effective compared to most of the alternatives in channeling youthful energy into productive self-control. Yeah, like, you know, regular mass attendance that you get in Catholic schools. Or like what they do at Northridge Prep, and I think Willows too, where you've got a free period where you can go to chapel or you can, you know, quietly study. But the point is that you institute this kind of culture of discipline and reflection and, you know, the demands of a grown-up. So three takeaways for Catholic schools. Against the backdrop of the failure of public schools, here's the way the public schools are going, right? This story out of the New York Post, here's what Bill de Blasio, the Sandinista mayor of New York City, as Larry Kudlow termed him. Here's what he's doing, unveiling a plan this weekend to boost black and Latino enrollment at the city's 8 specialized high schools by scrapping admissions tests. 20% of the seats at the 8 schools would be reserved for low-income applicants. Just
20%?
20%. Kids in the Department of Education's Discovery Program who scored just below the admissions cutoff would be given one of those saved seats, you know, the 20%. He wants to replace, does de Blasio, the single test system with new admissions criteria based on middle school class rank and state test scores. And, of course, who's discriminated against the most when you start to play this game of distribution by race rather than academic performance or wherewithal. Who gets discriminated against the most? Asians.
Oh.
Asians. They make up Asian kids in New York, for example, are at this dominate the city's top high school. 74% of the population is Stuyvesant, 66 at Bronx Science, 61 at Brooklyn Tech. At Queens High School for Science at York College, 82% are Asian. And of course, they're, you know, single digits in terms of the fraction of the population. So exponentially outperforming their distribution by race within the population. And fine, right? It should be performance-based. But it's just interesting to see sort of the tale of two approaches. The public schools want to continue to push the pedal down on the soft bigotry of low expectations, whereas the Catholic schools continue to set standards and a model and replicate the model that's proven successful in educating children for, you know, decades and decades and decades in this country. And where do you want to send your kids? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. It also puts an exclamation point on the opportunities that will come from this tax credit scholarship program that was signed into law last year. You're talking about upwards of $500 million in scholarship funds for families to send their children to private, religious, and Catholic schools in Chicagoland and Illinois.
But there's so many of us who are in the middle that, yeah, and that's good for everyone, and I hope that they're taking advantage of it.
Right.
Because a lot of the parents from that I know that are, you know, lower income, they weren't familiar with the situation.
Well, maybe if you weren't driving around in that fancy 20-year-old Dodge Caravan.
It's a Chevy. It's a Town and Country.
Town and Country limited edition. That fancy car, you could afford to send Peyton and Eli to Catholic school.
I want you to know I got it detailed this weekend.
Uh-huh.
And it's still dirty.
The detailing is worth more than the car.
Exactly. That's what I said.
Ron on the south side.
$200.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, the unfortunate thing. Well, you know what? I remember when my son, and I will mention the school, attended Mount Carmel. And look, I don't know if people get offended. And I said within feet away, there was a public school, Hyde Park, and it was ran like a zoo. And I don't mind if people get offended because of the facts. The facts, I remember when I took my son to Mount Carmel, and they talked about the discipline, the rules of the school, and some parents got left, which was good. But see, and I'm going to go with this, but the unfortunate thing about it is that he's black. Okay, then I told you years ago when I first mentioned it to Danny Davis, he said some of the parents wouldn't be able to make a choice. But how is it that people who receive the SNAP program, they don't tell you, you can go to any grocery store you want to, whether it's public, private, it doesn't matter. They give people a choice. Same thing with housing. That's because, you know what, you're not facing an opposition like the public school systems. But I will fight all the rest of my life for vouchers so we can have some choices. So thanks. Have a good day.
Amen, Ron. Thanks for the call. Bill in LaSalle County.
Hi, good morning. Just FYI, we sent our son, our youngest son, to Marmion Academy.
Sure.
It's an all-boys high school with the Army JROTC program.
Yeah.
Don't discount the leadership training that comes from that also, because there are some quality schools in the Chicago area like Phoenix Military Academy that also teach the kids about leadership and discipline and that too. Now, obviously, Marmion provides a very quality education, both in math and things like the languages, Latin and so forth. And as a result of it, my son is going to MIT next year.
Mm. I'm sorry he couldn't get into Bennett, but that's great that he's going to MIT.
Oh, cadets rule, Dan. Cadets rule, baby.
Thanks, Bill. That's great.
What was supposed to be your public school?
And by the way, Bennett was in the old West Suburban Catholic, Marmion, St. Francis,
right.
Bennett.
Oh, yeah, I know it well.
Set, right? And then we upgraded to the East Suburban Catholic.
Oh,
and
snot.
Just went from dominating the West Suburban Catholic
to dominating the world.
Yeah.
What public school were you supposed to go to?
If I would have gone to a public school.
Don't. Hey.
No. It would have been Wheaton Central at the time, which is now a Mariano's.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wheaton Central's gone?
Yeah, it's gone.
So you have Wheaton North?
Wheaton North and Wheaton Warrenville South.
Okay.
Yeah. Which are both good schools. I mean,
was your homeroom in the meat department?
Yeah, yeah, it would have been. It would have been. But think about the lunches.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and so this story out of Denver, a Mile High Spirits Distillery and Tasting Bar. Off-duty FBI agent is getting his groove on.
Getting his drink on and then getting his groove on. He joined a breakdancing circle.
Well, he sort of, yeah, right. He was center circle. And then he wanted to show off how he could cut a rug, as the kids like to say, in 1920.
And he decided to do a backflip.
I think it's technically a back handspring.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was a backhand. Yeah, it was a backflip. Sorry.
I mean, I hate to
a flip-flop.
Pull rank
sorry,
in
it was
terms
a flip-flop.
Of dancing moves. But
well, you are a former breakdancer.
And runner-up for the Arthur Murray Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah. You ain't first, you last, Ricky Bobby. Yeah, well, this woman was at the dance.
Mm-hmm. It was a breakdance circle, like quintessential breakdance circle. There was one man who was doing flips, and then he left, and the FBI agent, I guess, we didn't know that, he came on the scene and he did a backflip. And he was dancing, and then right as he did that backflip, his gun fell out and it hit the ground. Mm-hmm. It shot off.
Yeah, so hit the ground, then he went to pick it up, and he discharged it, shooting another patron in the leg.
I mean, and then he quickly put it back behind his, you know, in his back of his pants, and then did one of these, like, gotta go.
Did a
and
Comey.
Walked, then
pulled
walked,
a Comey.
Walked out.
Nothing to see here.
FBI has no comment this morning, but they yeah, are investigating. Really? Well, Denver police are deciding whether or not to press charges against him. But why would he grab his weapon? He could have just taken a deep breath, picked it up, you know, in the proper spot so he didn't, you know, shoot it. Because the bullet hit some guy's leg, and he had to go to the hospital. He's going to be fine, but still.
I bet a lot
don't
of
you know how to properly pick up a weapon, Dan?
I bet as a lot of his colleagues have comments at the office. This is one of those stories where you never really live it down. I mean,
never.
He's not going to be fired because he's a federal employee. So let's not be ridiculous here. He'll probably get, you know, a two-week paid suspension or something. But this is going to be something where it'll be interesting, like, when he goes for confirmation hearings to be FBI director, if this comes up, how the senators will inquire about this incident, say, 10 years from now when he's slated to be FBI director to follow in the lines of the Comeys of the world. The good news is, in the interim, he's provided an opportunity for the Zucker brothers to resuscitate the Naked Gun franchise.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, Leslie Nielsen, rest in peace, not with us, so somebody else has to pick up the mantle, and I think this guy, you know, has the material. I like the cut of this guy's jib. What can I say? And we did, by the way, we did get a little bit of audio from him. The FBI is not commenting, but he is commenting. We got a little of the back and forth between him and a supervisor at the FBI about what happened.
Oh, Drebin, I don't want any more trouble like you had last year on the South Side. Understand? That's my policy.
Yes, well, when I see five weirdos dressed in togas stabbing a guy in the middle of the park in full view of 100 people, I shoot the bastards. That's my policy.
That was a Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar, you moron. You killed five actors. Good ones.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Gallup is out with their annual poll surveying Americans' views on top moral issues, including same-sex relations, having a child out of marriage, sex outside of marriage, and divorce. The survey finds that views have on these issues have shifted dramatically left since the early part of the century. Americans who describe themselves as socially liberal is about as many as those who say they're socially conservative. In the past, those who described themselves as conservative outnumbered liberals by a significant margin. Now it's evened up. And on the issue matrix, for example, same-sex relations increased in acceptance the most, going from 40% in the first year was asked to 63% in 2017. Having a baby outside of marriage has gone from an acceptance of 45% in its first year of the surveys to 62% in 2017. That's the second biggest change in the survey. 62%. So we talk about the disintegration of the family, the spike in illegitimacy rates across populations, by race, most pronounced in the black community, but Latino community, white community, not far behind. And, the importance of a dad in the home, a dad in the child's life. And yet, because it's happening, more and more people are inclined to just accept the reality around them rather than suggest it's a problem, a societal ill. Extramarital affairs, gambling, birth control, abortion, cloning animals, buying and wearing animal fur, the least amount of change over the years, ranging from 1 to 3 percentage points. Medical testing on animals, a substantial change over the past 16 years. 65% found the practice acceptable in 2001. Now it's only 51%. That's where you want to make a stand, huh? Okay. This is, again, Gallup's annual values and beliefs poll, which began in 2001, just asking Americans whether a certain practice was morally acceptable or morally wrong. Is there such a thing as morally acceptable or morally wrong anymore? Or is it just everybody living their truth? This great, as Ross Douthat writes over the weekend in the New York Times, not culture war, but has the culture war devolved into a pop culture war? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. We're just economic man and woman. We don't care about these issues, so anything goes. Douthat writes, in response to the controversy last week with Roseanne Barr and Samantha Bee, starts out that the first time he wrote about Samantha Bee was back in 2016 during the presidential campaign, suggesting that Samantha Bee and I'm reading from Douthat here, her fellow late-night liberal shouters were actually doing more for the Republican nominee than was Fallon, because Trump's appeal was in part a reaction to the pervasive late Obama-era politicization of pop culture, which was encouraging Republican voting as a form of cultural protest, people being ridiculed culturally, as we've talked about.
Right.
Hurt economically under Obama, ridiculed socially, culturally, and Trump is in part a reaction to that. Douthat goes on to say, though, Trump himself, entirely a creature of the celebrity entertainment complex, he's always played this game and he has no interest in playing others, any other. For Trump, fighting with late night hosts and pro athletes is an end unto itself. People's administration have substantive goals, but to the president, ratings and faves and cancellations and boycotts are the real way you keep score. It's too easy or too simple to blame Trump when somebody of his supporters clearly love his style. Having lost so many cultural battles, the right has developed a desperate attraction to celebrity ephemera, confusing an epiphenomenon of progressives' cultural advantage, the fact that most famous actors and artists are left-wing, with the institutional advantage itself. So conservatives stupidly place hopes in a right-wing Kanye or Trump-friendly Roseanne Barr. They convince themselves that celebrity provocateurs will make America's campuses more conservative. But they don't understand how liberal cultural power works, writes Douthat. It's the steady circulation of ideas and money and people through cultural institutions that really matter, not the famous faces popping off on Oscar telecasts. That's an important point. That's an important point. As he writes, steady circulation of ideas and money and people through cultural institutions, that's what really matters. It's not the one-off cult of personality. It's not the one-off, you know, Kanye tweet, Roseanne episode, Tommy Lahren pronouncement, frankly. It's the hard work of sort of institution building and content production. And I'm not talking about the one-off tweet. And so you understand that conservatives aren't seeing how this works to some extent. Some aren't, those that kind of rally to the defense of a bar or obsess with Samantha Bee being fired. And so they
Samantha Bee's not fired. But I mean,
obsess
Roseanne,
about her being fired. Yeah, like they want her to be fired.
No,
yeah,
she's going to make a formal apology today.
Who cares?
And I know. Never even watched her. I didn't even know who she was.
Well, this is the point, and this is the problem. You're playing a pop culture war by their rules. The fact that you're playing a pop culture war at all is by definition their turf, and that's why you're losing. We are losing as a conservative, and that's why. Some of us cannot understand why these institutions that have so much sway continue to be dominated by the hard left in spite of performance. College campuses, entertainment, sports. Right? They don't get it. They don't get it. I'm boycotting. I'm not paying attention until, you know, you have one exemplar in one of those sectors say something consistent, and then you run to embrace that person, or they attack, you know, somebody on the left, and you run to embrace that person, and you think that's moving the needle. It's not moving the needle, not really. What's happened? I mean, and this is sort of the survey, and then this pop culture war that Dothat writes about. David Brooks, actually, New York Times, had a good piece last week about the failure of the educated elite. They failed substantively, but they continue to dominate these elite institutions. Point that he makes, though, is they've created this idea where all you are is a vessel for your skill sets. All you are is, as I said, economic man and woman, which is what we focus on. I don't want to talk about social issues. Let's have, as Mitch Daniels argued, let's have a truce on social issues. Character doesn't matter. And so what are you left with at the end of the day that's unifying and transcendent?
And an ancillary issue, Bill Clinton was talking about character, former President Bill Clinton, and about President Trump, and said he should watch what he tweets.
I don't like all this. I couldn't be elected anything now because I just don't like embarrassing people. My mother would have whipped me for 5 days in a row when I was a little boy if I spent all my time bad-mouthing people like this.
You don't like embarrassing people. You humiliated your wife to the global community by having relations with a 21-year-old or 20-year-old intern when you were president. You disgraced yourself and the office, your marriage, your family, but you don't like embarrassing people. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. Yeah. But rather than having a standard by which you hold Trump and Bill Clinton and everybody else to, you just do this, you know, Bill Clinton did it. That's the defense. It's always our side versus their side. You know, it's the no, pardon the phrase, tit for tat.
What's wrong with tit for tat? It's tit for tat.
Well, it's standard free. It's okay that my guy did it because your guy did it 20 years ago. My guy's a scumbag. This guy over here on your side's a scumbag, too.
And Bill Clinton said if Trump was a Democrat, he'd be impeached by now.
I think
so
if the roles were reversed now, he's just talking about it based on my experience. If there were a Democratic president and these facts were present, most people I know in Washington believe impeachment hearings would have begun already.
It doesn't even make any sense. The follow-up question, if he was on Face the Nation, if they weren't asleep at the switch on these
Sunday morning,
CBS.
It's non-confrontational.
Really? So if President Trump was a Democrat and the House was controlled by Democrats, he'd be impeached? Is that what? Is that what he's saying? Does anybody believe that? Of course not. No. If the House was under Democratic control during the Clinton impeachment, do you think he would have been impeached? Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. And Bill Clinton's a great example of this pop culture war. It's just a different variety than Obama and Trump. So in Brooks's piece, he talks about the failure of the educated elite. You know, people that we talk to and we're talking about. and people in control of the institutions that are so influential, also in your child's lives, in addition to your own. The new meritocratic aristocracy has come to look like every other aristocracy, writes Brooks. The members of the educated class use their intellectual, financial, social advantages to pass down privilege to their children, creating a hereditary elite that is ever more insulated from the rest of society. We need to build a meritocracy that's true to its values, truly open to all. Yeah, I mean, Brooks, you know, he's sort of on the right street, the wrong address, but he does make a couple of points about the meritocracy built on the maximization of individual talent. Only puts an exaggerated faith in intelligence. We've talked about that before. The intelligence bias. Somebody's smart, so they can't be bad. It's very similar to the wealthy guy bias. Somebody's wealthy, so they must be a genius at everything. Wrong. Misplaced faith in autonomy. The old aristocracy, the dim-witted, stuck-up blue bloods, those old white guys and dead white guys that everybody's supposed to loathe, the old Protestant blue bloods, right? And the old establishment has something we meritocrats lack, a civic consciousness, a sense that we live embedded in community and nation, that we owe a debt to community and nation, and that the essence of the admirable life is community before self. In Catholic parlance, that would be being a servant leader. And Brooks is absolutely right about that. And then one other point, he talks about the meritocracy instigating several ruinous beliefs. Another one is misplaced idealization of diversity. It's good to hear this from a center leftist like Brooks, who thinks he's center right. The great achievement of the meritocracy is that it's widened opportunities to those who were formerly oppressed. But diversity is a midpoint, not an endpoint. Midpoint, not an endpoint. Just as a mind has to be opened so that it can close on something, an organization has to be diverse so that perspectives can serve some end. Diversity for its own sake, without a common telos, is infinitely centrifugal and leads to social fragmentation. That's what we have now on college campuses and all these elite institutions that we spend so much money to send our kids through, so much time accessing, being influenced by, interacting with. I mean, it's amazing to me how few people contemplate, discuss the kind of society we live in, the kind of world you want to have been recorded as advancing during your fleeting time here. You don't care at all about the cultural norms around you, just about what's on your paycheck every 2 weeks. That's it? Seems sort of banal and trivial at the end of the day, doesn't it? I mean, I know everybody's got to survive and everybody's got to pay the rent and work hard doing it and raise kids and balance all kinds of interests. I get it. But I go back to what he said. This doesn't have to be just the province of the stuck-up blue bloods of a bygone era. Civic consciousness, a sense that we live embedded in community and nation. We owe a debt to community and nation. But when you say anything goes, as the American populace increasingly is, as so indicated by this Gallup survey. Mike, and on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. You started off the segment talking about sex outside of marriage, and the poster child for that is coming to Chicago. Stormy Daniels is going to be at the Admiral Theater the week of your golf outing, and I wanted to know if you were going to be doing any remotes from the Admiral.
No, I'm not. Thanks for the call, Mike. We're not going to be doing that.
They close at 6 a.m., so technically we could do some show prep from 3 to 4 and then come on in here, see what happens.
And you are, consistent with the times, trying to kind of get with it. You are going to reach out to Stormy Daniels to try and bring her to the golf
outing. Yes, she'd be great.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy.
They did. I went to the Pac-12 tournament, and Stanford has a tree as a mascot. I know they're the Cardinals, but they have a guy in a tree.
The Cardinal, singular.
Cardinal.
Yeah. Name 10 schools that have whose mascot is singular, not plural.
Cardinal.
Uh-huh. Give me another one.
Hold on. Hoosiers, Boilermakers.
Oh, boy. This is going to take
Hawkeyes.
A while. Yeah. Meanwhile.
Illini.
Yeah, that's one.
Boom, I got two. I'm
all
out.
Right. We'll continue that all morning. I'll fill in the rest of the blanks, but I'll give you some time to think about it.
Okay.
Maybe add some more. University of Michigan, they're the Wolverines, plural.
Yeah.
The Harbaughs. This is interesting from our friend Mark Perry, who's an economics professor at University of Michigan. You know how there's $1.5 trillion in student loan debt, a delinquency rate of about 11%, and people are struggling to get a return on the investment they make in higher education when you're talking about piling up six figures in debt to get your BA. University of Michigan employs I should preface this by saying, in terms of the college spend, why in part is college spend, along with healthcare spend, so far outpacing inflation, much less a middle-income family's ability to pay? Administrative positions at colleges and universities grew by 60% between the years 1993 and 2009, 10 times the rate of growth of tenured faculty positions. The eduocracy. The University of Michigan, for example, employs a diversity staff of nearly 100. 93 full-time diversity administrators, officers, directors, vice provosts, deans, consultants, specialists, investigators, managers, executive assistants, administrative assistants, analysts, and coordinators. More than a quarter of those diversocrats, as Mark Perry calls them, earn annual salaries of more than 100 grand. The total payroll for this small army at University of Michigan, 93 diversity staffers, $8.5 million. You add the estimated 32% in terms of cost for the fringe benefit package these individuals get, and that compensation total goes to north of $11 million. The vice provost for equity and inclusion and chief diversity officer at Michigan makes, what do you think?
Oh, I don't even want to know. But I have a feeling you're going to tell me.
Michelle Obama range.
350?
400 grand.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous.
All the way down to the 26th north of 100 grand, who's the EEO/diversity rep senior for the Office of Institutional Equity. Okay, but we're winning. We're winning on the college campuses. We're winning the culture war, or as Ross Douthat said, we've actually lost it, and we're substituting it for the pop culture war to salve our feelings. Well, how about at Stanford Law? We like to go to the elite institutions. Normally, we're on the East Coast, but Stanford has been for a while one of the premier law and business schools. I mean, undergrad too. But law and business schools, most notably, with the lowest acceptance rate and so forth, very prestigious. Martin Salvucci is a law student there, and he wrote a piece for National Review, Political Correctness at Stanford Law, which, you know, maybe I'm becoming a bit inured to these stories that we cover routinely in our Campus Beat segment. When you're talking about students attacking professors like at Middlebury for the crime of walking around campus with Charles Murray, maybe I'm getting a little bit desensitized to just the normal totalitarian re-education that goes on college campuses, the projection of things that the professors and administrators are not, like intellectually curious and inclusive and tolerant of viewpoints that are not their own. Well, Stanford Law, Martin Salvucci reports, no more than 3 of the approximately 110 full-time faculty publicly identify as conservative or libertarian. As a consequence, many of my classmates will graduate having never engaged with a law professor whose worldview and convictions track those of nearly half the voting public. My classmates demonstrate little willingness to identify publicly with anything associated with conservatism or, God forbid, President Trump, no matter how trivial. By example, Martin Salvucci cites the law school Republicans on the campus of Stanford will soon cease to exist as a student organization because after a campaign of intimidation and opprobrium. Not one underclassman would volunteer to serve on the board of the law school Republicans next academic year. You know, everybody's got to be the team player, just like so many are in their corporate environments these days. Certainly if you're a member of in a leadership or subordinate role at a cultural institution of any import, with the exception of maybe Hillsdale College and a handful of others, you got to be a team player. And so that's the experience that Martin Salvucci writes about in this National Review piece, contrasting it to the experience he had when he was at the University of Chicago. And just to put a real world, real time example to what we talk about on college campuses all the time, pleased to have Martin Salvucci, Stanford Law student, join us now. Martin, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan. Really appreciate being here.
So you were at the Lumen Christi Institute. I remember I met you there when you were at University of Chicago. And I just wonder if you could contrast your experience was during your time in Hyde Park as compared to your time in Palo Alto.
Well, the weather's certainly better out here,
yes,
for
well,
starters.
Yes, yes.
But I would be hard-pressed to think of two more different universities. I mean, Stanford is a very user-friendly place. I think, you know, we have so much money that the answer is pretty much always yes, and the obsession is in user experience. It's very Silicon Valley. You know, Chicago, by contrast, I mean, if you ask for heat in the winter, you know, the impertinence of it is sort of horrifying to, you know, the person that you're asking. I mean, you're getting a University of Chicago education, you know, like how dare you want to go to bed without, you know, wearing 10 layers of clothes. I mean, that's just part of the experience. But on an intellectual level, I mean, there's also just no comparison. You know, in Chicago, there are no intellectual taboos. It's a serious place. I think it vindicates the vision that, you know, people like John Masefield had for a university more effectively than probably any other institution in the country, whereas Stanford is just not a serious place. I mean, I think here it's perfectly acceptable and indeed increasingly expected that someone can and will shut down what would otherwise be a sort of mainstream policy debate through some allegation of this is racist or this is sexist or some other sort of ism. And I think we all suffer as a result. I mean, it impoverishes the discourse, and I think the quality of the education that all of us receive as a result is suboptimal.
You mentioned in your article that some parties tore down posters advertising a recent program on abortion. What was that all about?
Yeah. So I'm very involved with the Stanford Federalist Society, and the Federalist Society, for those sort of unfamiliar with it, is an organization of conservative and libertarian-oriented lawyers deeply concerned by the state of the current legal order, and we try to arrange conversations around controversial contemporary topics in legal discourse. And we had a program on abortion back a couple of months ago, where we had a woman coming from the East Coast who was criticizing the regime of reliance-oriented jurisprudence after Casey, and then we had somebody from the Stanford campus who was going to respond to her. One of the hallmarks of Federalist Society events is that we always try to have a respondent, usually coming from a different ideological perspective. I think we're the only campus organization that's known to do that regularly, ironically. And what we noticed, I think the morning of or the morning before, it was the morning of, was that the posters that we put up around campus, many of them, I think almost all of them, were torn down and sort of left where they fell, which was concerning to us. And it seems pretty obvious what had happened. And when we went to the administration and we asked them to sort of help us through this, the suggestion was that perhaps, and, you know, I emphasize, I mean, they didn't say this happened for sure, but the only possibility that was posited was that our facilities staff, in their zeal to enforce the rules on postering, had torn these things down, which just seemed like a sort of risible falsehood to me, at least.
You reference in your piece that Stanford, the professors there, encourage or are tolerant of diversity of opinion, you know, sort of in the same way Ingsoc was, or there was some other Orwellian reference I'm misremembering. But I mean, you know, give us an example of this is, you know, arguably the best or in the top two or three law schools in the country. And so it's rather, I still find it rather remarkable that they pay homage to, you know, being open-minded and let's have arguments and you know, substantive arguments. And particularly for legal training, you got to be able to argue both sides. And yet what you're describing is something, as you said, where you're only getting one point of view, you're only getting one line of argumentation, and you're expected to hew the orthodoxy.
Yeah. So it's not total. There are at least a handful of professors who do make a good faith effort. I mean, one of the three conservatives, you know, professor, former judge Michael McConnell, is really good about this and forces conservative students to make sort of left-leaning arguments in class with some regularity. I think there are some professors outside the sort of narrowly political fields, Joe Bankman and tax and Lisa Willette and intellectual property, who really take this sort of pedagogical aspect of viewpoint diversity very seriously. But in the main, particularly the public law scholars at Stanford, they don't make a terribly serious effort. And a lot of the things that you hear in the classroom are just sort of horrifying. I mean, the day after Trump was elected, one of my classmates reported back to me that he was told by his civil procedure professor that, you know, this is sort of akin to the day after 9/11 when she was a law student here. Professor, a first-year professor, this year, chain migration is a racist term that shouldn't be used. In my own experience, I'd say, again, referencing a Federalist Society event where we had somebody in from the Heritage Foundation talking about criminal justice reform in a sort of very forward-thinking way. Professor is a very prominent empiricist, got up in front of everyone and said, I agree with everything that our friend John Malcolm just said. And then proceeded to go into a slideshow about how anybody who supported Trump was a white supremacist, and Trump and Dylann Roof, the guy who killed all those poor people in Charleston several years ago, were intimately connected on some philosophical level. And there's really sort of no adult minding the store when these sorts of things happen. And that's concerning to me, because while, you know, my classmates, and you know, to some degree are still children, and children can be expected to behave badly, now and forever, there's nothing new under the sun. The people who were supposed to be the adults, I think, at this moment in history, for whatever reason, have totally abdicated their responsibility. And that's deeply concerning, and I don't think it's the sort of thing that institutions like this survive easily. To your point, Dan, I do think it's the case that, you know, judges and potential employers understand the problems here. I mean, in the real world, as you know, as a former practicing lawyer, opposing counsel is zealously going to represent all of their best arguments, even if you find them distasteful. Judges have a wide variety of perspectives, especially outside of the Northern District of California. And frequently your clients will have done things that you find to be objectionable. And, you know, they still demand the same quantum of effort on your part. So, yeah, it's deeply concerning, and I don't see it getting better.
Well, the team player argument that you make, too, that you're sort of getting to that with what you were describing. And this is the culture that pervades all of our cultural institutions, perhaps most aggressively in higher education. And just like, I disagree with what's going on. But hey, look, I'm just here for 3 years to get out, to go to, a blue chip law firm, make a bunch of money, or go on to some, you know, outstanding success in some other field. I'm not going to rock the boat. The kind of not rocking the boat in the face of this sort of intolerance you see over and over again, even at Stanford.
Yeah. I'd say that the feedback that I've gotten to the essay has been in volume overwhelmingly positive. But what's been concerning regarding the positive feedback has been the sheer number of emails or conversations that I've had from or with liberal classmates who said some version of, Martin, we disagree politically, but I agree with
most or all of what you wrote in the essay. I think it's important that somebody says this. It requires a non-trivial degree of courage. And, oh, by the way, please don't tell a soul that I, you know, name X, believe any of this. I mean, and it's happened now double-digit numbers of times in the last week. And if I were a senior administrator, you know, at Stanford, either in the law school or the university, or a trustee or a potential employer, you know, again, I would look at that fact and I would need to take a long look in the mirror about what's going on, because it's obvious that this is a problem that's not just affecting them, students like me or you know, the other five right-wing students on this campus, but that, you know, it's seen as a problem by a great many people who don't necessarily want to subscribe to the lies that, for one reason or another, you know, are sort of all expected to, as you said before, hew to as orthodoxy.
Well, history's always changed by the committed few. So we got you and four other guys at Stanford. We got John David Rice Cameron, who is Susan Rice's son, who's a member of the College Republicans, California College Republicans. So there's a ray of hope. He calls Mark Levin his like intellectual political hero.
Oh, that's good.
So you know, there's some seeds being planted out in the West Coast. Martin Salvucci, Stanford law student, the piece on National Review, PC at Stanford. I tweeted it out at Dan Prof. You can check it out, and you should. Martin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And he joins us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I've got some good news, and I've got some bad news for you. Obviously, the jobs report on Friday was good news. Also this, the federal government cut 3,000 jobs in May. Federal employment has now dropped by 24,000 since President Trump took office. Now, that's 24,000 out of... 2.8 million, just about. So it's an infinitesimal drop, but a drop nonetheless. You know, baby steps here. So that's the good news. Reducing the headcount reduces ostensibly the size and scope of government, which is part of the challenge. Also consistent with the deregulation that's been a signature of Trump's economic success so far. The bad news is the tariffs that are going up and the potential economic toll that they could impose, Larry Kudlow's continuing optimism notwithstanding. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
So let's start with the jobs numbers last week and where you think this president's and his administration's economic policy is sort of globally.
Well, the really good news is that when we got the business rates down, tax rates from 35, highest in the world, down to 21%, which puts us ahead of most countries in the world. It's not everything we need, but it was a very good start. I still support President Trump's drive to get to 15. That would make us one of the lowest in the world. Ireland's at 12.5. That changed the ballgame. You started to see this year $700 billion has been committed to come back to the United States. This is American corporate earnings overseas that our own tax policy kept out of the United States. $700 billion flowing to the United States this year. Other countries, when they decide where to invest, you know, somebody in Japan or Brazil or the United Arab Emirates, they used to look at Germany, and Germany had a 25% tax. We have 35%. And they'd invest in Germany. Now more of them will be investing in the United States. The Fed in Atlanta Fed, has a projection on GDP growth for the next quarter, the second quarter, which means through the end of June. They're projecting 4.7%. Now, during Obama, we were under 2. For the last year, last 12 months, the Trump administration, we've been at 3, and they're not talking about more than 4. So this is tremendous growth, and it's all driven by the lower regulation burden and the tax cut.
Well, right, you had the tax cut on the personal and corporate income side, but you've got a tax increase because that's what a tariff is with Trump's trade policy. How does that shake out?
Well, it's not helpful. It is small compared to the size of the tax cut and the size of the capital flows into the United States. But all tariffs are simply taxes. They raise the cost of goods for Americans, not for foreigners. And I don't know why they call them a trade war. In shooting wars, you go and shoot somebody in the other country.
Right.
In trade wars, you shoot people in your own country. The damage done by tariffs is not on foreigners. It raises the price of what Americans buy. And it also hurts our exports, because when we import raw material like steel or aluminum, what the challenge is that we make things out of that and then want to export them. But now we're going to have higher prices. We have a very high sugar quota. We raise the price of sugar, about double it, because of our quotas and various government programs. That means candy manufacturing has over time moved out of the United States, because the input, the sugar, the raw material, is so much more important and expensive here in the United States. So this is not good for our exports. It's bad policy. I understand the president is using it as a blunt instrument to get other countries to open their markets. And to the extent that that works, as it seemed to have in South Korea, that's helpful. But if it devolves into a Hatfield versus McCoy's long-running trade war, that's Great Depression stuff. It's not helpful.
Well, but also, too, isn't this the wrong solution misapplied, to borrow a Groucho Marxism here? Douglas Irwin, economist from Dartmouth, over the weekend in the Wall Street Journal, made the point, look, we produce 73% of all the steel we consume. So it's not like we're out of the industry or the U.S. has lost its steel industry. The U.S. has lost steel jobs, but that's because in 1980 it took 10 worker hours to produce a ton of steel. Today it takes less than 2 worker hours, just the efficiency through technology. And so the idea of punishing some of our trading partners with respect to steel imports, that really makes even less sense when you look at the context of this data.
Yeah, you do have to look at how much you're producing rather than how many people you're employing. We make a great deal more food in the United States. We grow a lot more corn, wheat, rice than we ever did 100 years ago. But 100 years ago, more than half the population was on the farm. Today, it's less than 2%. That's not a bad thing. It's a good thing, because people have other jobs that pay more, and farmers are more productive, and farmers get paid more today than they did 100 years ago. So, yes, we need to be looking at what we're producing, steel, aluminum, wheat, you know, pork, all those things. And the good news is we're getting more everything except the government is getting more productive in how it does stuff.
But why did President Trump, he's pouring salt in the wound, saying that the steel tariffs are needed as a security measure. Listen to the Prime Minister of Canada.
The idea that the Canadian steel that's in military vehicles in the United States, the Canadian aluminum that makes your fighter jets, is somehow now a threat. The idea that we are somehow a national security threat to the United States is quite frankly insulting and unacceptable.
So the U.S. is isolated. The Canadians are insulted, and then the finance ministers of 6 countries issued this rare rebuke. Do you think President Trump, can anybody get to him and tell him that these are our friends, they're our allies?
Well, if anyone can, it's Larry Kudlow. And there is somebody in the middle of the White House who fully understands the benefits of free trade, and that if threatening people with tariffs is not getting us open markets, we need to do something else. And, of course, the reason why the president has to say it's national security, and the reason he insults France and England and our NATO partners and Canada, is that the law he's invoking to do this unilaterally, as the president, the way Obama used to do stuff all by himself, allows the president to do it, but only if the excuse is national security. So he doesn't mean to be insulting Canada, but in order to stay within the law, he has to claim this is because of national security.
He is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be with you. Tariffs are taxes.
There you go. As simple as that. And blaming Canada is a South Park movie.
We must stop dirty language from getting to- into our children's ears. We must go fight the source of it. But what is the source?
Oh, that's easy.
Times have changed. Our kids are getting worse. They won't obey their parents. They just want to fart and curse.
Should we blame the government or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No, blame Canada.
Blame Canada.
For their beady little eyes and flap their heads on more alive.
Blame Canada. Blame Canada.
We need to form a full assault.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Things are getting hot. On the Today Show, Craig Melvin was interviewing President Clinton and James Patterson about their upcoming novel that they're working on.
The president is missing. A president gets impeached. I mean, it's James Patterson. Come on. The guy did Kiss the Girls. He's defiling himself by writing a book with Bill Clinton.
Well, Craig Melvin asked him, did you apologize to Monica Lewinsky?
No, I felt terrible then, and I came to grips with it.
Did you ever apologize to her?
Yes, and nobody believes that I got out of that for free. I left the White House $16 million in debt.
Oh, yeah, couldn't afford the mortgages.
Now he's the victim.
But you typically have ignored gaping facts in describing this, and I bet you don't even know them. This was litigated 20 years ago. Two-thirds of the American people sided with me.
Yeah.
They were not insensitive to that. I had a sexual harassment policy when I was governor in the 80s.
That I could sexually harass whoever I wanted.
I had two women chiefs of staff.
Then he went on and on about how he's hired all these women. But, okay, did you or did you not apologize to her face-to-face, Bill Clinton?
But you didn't apologize to her.
I have not talked to her.
Do you feel like I thought owe her an apology?
No, I do. I've never talked to her, but I did say publicly on more than one occasion that I was sorry.
Sorry, guys.
That's very different. The apology was public.
Yeah, that is very different.
And you don't think a private apology is owed?
I think this thing has been, it's 20 years ago. Come on, let's talk about JFK. Let's talk about, LBJ. Stop already.
I don't think President Kennedy should have resigned?
Yeah, but he didn't lie under oath.
Do you believe President Johnson should have resigned? Someone should ask
yes.
you these questions just because of the way you formulate the questions. I dealt with it 20 years ago plus, and the American people, two-thirds of them, stayed with me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I've tried to do a good job since then with my life and with my work.
Yeah, the great.
That's all I have to say.
This novel with Patterson and the Clinton Global Initiative. It's great. What great legacies. Quite a mouthful.
And they brought it up because it's the whole Me Too movement.
Oh, I understand that. In addition, 20 years ago, well, hey, Mr. President, 20 years later, Monica Lewinsky still can't find a fella because of you.
Right. Do you think she's owed a face-to-face personal apology or a letter?
Well, when he says,
maybe he could tweet her an apology.
I've apologized to the world. He's apologizing for disgracing the office, for disgracing his family, for lying under oath, kind of a general apology.
It's just but what your meaning of sex is.
Yeah, well, right. Yeah, he knows an apology for bastardizing the English language, number one. Number two, I mean, the question I would put to him is, what would you say if not to do a Bernie Shaw to Michael Dukakis thing here, but if Chelsea Clinton had been interning at a Fortune 100 company when she was a 20-year-old college student, and a 50-something CEO
married with children
had engaged in illicit acts with her, what would you say about that guy and what he did and whether he owed your daughter an apology for essentially his predatory behavior? What would you say? That would be a more interesting question, but I'm not on the Today Show.
No, you should be.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Rudy Giuliani says that Trump could put Jim Comey in a woodchipper. Woodchipper, I should say, or woodchopper.
Okay, Fargo.
And still not be prosecuted. It's part of the presidential power. He also suggests that Trump can pardon himself. Why would he need to? He didn't answer that, but this is what he said on Sunday with Clinton Foundation Donor Zero.
Do you and the president's attorneys believe the president has the power to pardon himself?
He's not, but he probably does. I mean, he has no intention of pardoning himself, but he probably does. It doesn't say he can't. I mean, that's another really interesting constitutional argument. Can the president pardon himself?
I think it's an open question?
I used to run the pardon attorney. It would be an open question. I think it would probably get answered by, gosh, that's what the Constitution says, and if you want to change it, change it. But, yeah.
And then President Trump tweeted less than a half hour ago, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon, all in capital letters, pardon myself, but why would I do that when I've done nothing wrong?
Yeah,
in the meantime,
exactly.
The never-ending witch hunt led by 13 very angry and conflicted Democrats and others continues into the midterms, exclamation point.
Well, that's I don't understand why Rudy Giuliani didn't make that point. I mean, arguably he could. You'd have to see which way the Supreme Court would fall on that more than likely. But why would he need to? Because there's nothing that he's done that would necessitate a pardon. I don't know why he didn't make that case. Now, the more relevant topic, at least with what we know publicly, is the question of the subpoena. And if the president was subpoenaed by Mueller, would they comply or would they fight it?
In addition to the constitutional issue, which will be, you know, a complex one, we admit that, although we think we have the better argument. The one that's definitive is the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel and the Justice Department, wrote a memo at the conclusion of the Clinton thing and the Clinton administration and said, you cannot indict a sitting president, nor can you compel process. So it's part of the rules of the Justice Department. And Mueller is
has
nothing.
Has he responded to the letter?
Has not.
No response to the letter.
And Mueller is completely surrounded by the rules of the Justice Department and agreed to follow them.
So Giuliani is saying he can't do that. And if he tries to do it, essentially, we're going to fight it. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Michael Goodwin, New York Post columnist and Fox News contributor. His most recent piece in the Post is James Comey isn't above the law. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, guys. Thank you.
I'll let you make your case about Jim Comey not being above the law, although I certainly agree. But what about Rudy's metaphor? You know, he could shoot Jim Comey and he wouldn't be prosecuted. I know he's trying to be colorful and illustrate the legal argument, but doesn't it just come across as saying that the president, indicating the president is above the law? Isn't that troubling at all, some of the rhetoric coming from Trump's legal team?
Well, look, I think there are two ways to look at it. One is kind of in a room of legal scholars debating the fine points of the Constitution and the Justice Department regulations, and the other is on Sunday morning television. And I think what Rudy said there, as you correctly note, it doesn't translate to people watching that. I mean, they don't get the finer points. This is a kind of exploratory mindset that Rudy has taken in a number of these interviews, and I think he's thrown a lot of things in the air that are extremely provocative in ways that only muddy the waters as to what the real legal issues are, and frankly, what whether Trump bears any guilt, whether he's done anything that would lead to an indictment, would lead to a subpoena. So I think Rudy would be advised to, he doesn't have to answer every question in a kind of totally hypothetical, ultimate, extreme way. He can simply, I think, lay out the contours of the Constitution and the Justice Department regulation. I mean, he's a good lawyer. He was a very good lawyer. I think he's showing a lot of rust in some of these interviews.
Do you think, even before he hit the Sunday talk shows and gave that, bizarre hypothetical to the Huffington Post, on Saturday, he's cranking up the tension with Robert Mueller saying that he's going to fight the subpoena. Is that, what are your thoughts on all of it? I mean, should President Trump even sit down? Because I think it's a perjury trap.
Right. Look, I think that's the ultimate conclusion they've reached is that that an interview with the president would not serve the president. And I thought, and so I think that's what the subpoena, again, the legal argument. To our knowledge, there has been no subpoena. So this is, again, a theoretical conversation. It's an important one, but I think it's getting lost as to where we really are in this process. I thought the revelation over the weekend of the letter that Trump's team wrote mm-hmm. to Mueller in January, now some time ago, but I thought the points it raised were interesting, that essentially, what evidence do you have to show us that you need an interview with the president? In other words, it should be the last resort. It should be when you cannot get the information otherwise. And we have given you over 1 million documents. How can, and you've interviewed lots and lots of people, including the White House, how can it be that you don't have everything you need? And if not, what is it that you need? And so I think it's a way of trying to get to what does Mueller have? What is he looking at exactly? And so Mueller apparently responds with those list of questions that were leaked, some 50 questions that, in a way, were not very detailed. Many of them struck me as just fishing, as though he had nothing. But so I think that's the reason that the president's team sees. You go in there, you sit down, they don't really have anything, but they just keep throwing things at you, and at some point you're going to contradict yourself, you're going to contradict what they know or what you've said elsewhere. Ah, perjury. So I think that is their thinking, that unless Mueller can really narrow down what he wants to ask the president, and again, this is not just about Trump. I think we have to remember, too, that's what Giuliani and even the president in the tweet you referenced. He's talking about executive privilege. He's talking about the power of the Oval Office that transcends him or any individual successor. And I think that's where the best arguments lie. And I think Rudy, unfortunately, is clouding the water with all of this extreme, hypothetical.
Well, and a good example of the president potentially tripping himself up is included in that 20-page memo that was leaked that you're describing. With respect to his involvement in writing the statement in response to the revelation about the Trump Tower meeting with the Russian lawyer Veselnitskaya, and you know, in him allegedly dictating a statement to Don Jr. in response to the public inquiry, which is not consistent with what he said subsequently. But the other thing that's interesting about the memo is, you know, they go right to the suggestion that the firing of Comey, this is one of the big touchstones. That's a possible indicator of obstruction. And they essentially lay out the case. Look, even if you don't believe that the president can't be charged or pursued for obstruction of justice with terminating somebody for whatever reason that's under his authority, look at what Jim Comey said. Jim Comey essentially said after the Let It Go meeting over General Flynn that the relationship was fine. He never pursued the Let It Go. He never thought he was being interfered with. He subsequently said in correspondence that the relationship is fine. I think I'm going to be here for another 6.5 years and all this stuff. So, kind of what evidence is there that where you're trying to go has the possibility to bear any fruit?
Look, I mean, I think that's well said, that there is, that's the effort to get Mueller to focus more directly on what it is he's looking at, because many have made this point, as you just did, Alan Dershowitz included, that the president can fire anybody. I mean, that's the executive power. Anybody who works for him to say otherwise, even to protect a general counsel, a special counsel, would be to curb the executive power, and that's not constitutional. So I think there are a lot of arguments on that. But look, I think we also even here need to recall some of the background of Mueller's investigation itself. That Trump feels the whole thing is part of a campaign to delegitimize his election. And so I think the president and his team are not just trying to protect him, his own career, but also this notion that everything about Mueller, the Russian dossier, the FISA warrants, all of the cloud about how that was obtained, that Clinton paid for it, that Sidney Blumenthal was involved in some of this, that what was Clapper doing, what was Brennan doing, what was Comey doing during the election. All of that, I think, for Trump is still a huge hurdle because someone said to me the other day, why didn't he just come out and say what Russia did was horrible? Well, because I think that is exactly what Hillary Clinton wants to argue continually. And many Democrats on the left still argue that Trump was illegitimately elected. And there's absolutely no evidence of that. But from Trump's point of view, Mueller's entire investigation is based on that false claim. And so I think that's why the president sometimes gets tripped up trying. He looks like he's shadow boxing because he is. There is a shadow that has been created over his election, over his administration, that Mueller will not let go. As long as Mueller is doing his investigation, that shadow remains. And I think that is the larger context here.
Yeah, and to your point, I mean, it was just last week, Jim Clapper on his own book tour suggests that the Russians threw the election to Trump without any evidence. Even nobody from the Obama administration other than him has even gone so far as to say that. It's just
That's
so
right.
reckless.
And he has said exactly the opposite in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, he is Michael Goodwin. His most recent piece, the New York Post, James Comey isn't above the law. You want to check that out. New York Post columnist, Fox News contributor, Michael, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Time to play America's favorite game. Would you rather date a Trump supporter or a MS-13 gangbanger?
Who I just called her an MSG?
Yeah, hold the MSG. MS-13 gangbanger or Trump supporter. Daily Caller sends a couple of their intrepid reporters to do some man-on-the-street Q&A on the topic. Here's what they found from a cross-section of the American public.
Which one would you date? An MS-13 gang member or a Trump supporter?
Oh,
come on.
Oh, gang member.
Give it a gang member!
So I'm going to go MS-13.
Yeah, probably MS-13 member.
MS-13.
MS-13. All the way.
Neither. I'll stay single.
It's embarrassing that I don't know what an MS-13 gang member is. Can someone tell me what that is? I'm not going to date either of them, I don't think.
I guess a Trump supporter, because I guess at least they stand for something.
MS-13. Why? Why an MS-13 gang member?
Because I lived in Bolivia, so I understand a little bit of the culture.
Not
the
for
rape,
the Trump
the rape
supporters.
And murder culture?
No, I mean, your choice is your choice, but not for me.
What if it was Kylie?
Ooh, what sauce are you on? Still not a Trump supporter, but probably MS-13 gang member.
Yeah, a lot of Trump supporters were probably raised by rich white dads and people with lots and lots of money, yeah. And they're bred into being Trump supporters. I'm from Connecticut, and I can tell you 80% of the girls in high school would say that they were Republican when they were in high school because their dads were rich white dads, and they had no idea what Republican even meant.
Yeah, hey, dumbass from Connecticut, wow. Read Hillbill Elegy about those rich white families that put Trump over the top, you dingbat. Now, I'm going to throw a wrinkle on this, Amy.
Uh-oh.
All right.
Hold the MSG.
Right. I'm going to do that. MS-13, Trump supporter.
Or
John Hamm in the... John Hamm. Mm-hmm. John, okay. Do you know who John Hamm is?
Yeah, sure.
You don't know who John Hamm is?
No, yes, I do.
John Hamm, on a show 25 years ago, before he became Don Draper, called...
Oh, John Hamm.
I think The Big Date was the name of it. The Big Date, John Hamm.
I know
Hamm.
Who John Hamm is. Born in St. Louis, Missouri.
Do we have that John Hamm drop?
Oh, it'd be a shame if we didn't.
How about you, John? You're on a first date, marries the girl, you want to really impress her. How do you make her feel special?
Well, start off with some fabulous food, a little fabulous conversation.
Okay. What else fabulous, John?
End it with a fabulous foot massage for an evening of total fabulosity.
Ah, very good, John. All right, Mary, here are our choices.
How about that, ladies?
Mark's going to take you out for dinner,
And then he's going to take you home and show him, show you why he's a stuntman and show you his flexibility. You offered some wrestling. That's all up to you guys. I don't have anything to do with that part. Marcus wants to take you out to a nice little dinner, but actually what I'm going to do is a little Vegas, a little mountain climbing, a little bike riding, and all the time holding you and cuddling you. I don't think it's physically possible, but if he could do it, it might be a cool day. And John is just all about anything fabulous for you, Mary. So time to make a choice. Which one of these guys do you want to get to know?
I'll take the MS-13 gangbanger from those three.
John Hamm would play Aaron Rodgers if there was ever a movie made about Aaron Rodgers.
Was he? So 25 years ago, John Hamm was a bit of a D-bag, in case you didn't pick up on Mr. Fabulous there. And something else that we often talk about.
What?
Listening to John Hamm have to speak in his own voice tells you what? How good the writers for Mad Men were.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, fresh off of his meeting with Kim Thong-un last week.
Oh, Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
Trump meets the rump.
New York Postism. Trump and the summit meeting with Kim Jong-un is back on, but it's going to be more of like an ice cream social.
Well, more of a meet and greet, kind of a rush, you know, when you rush each other to see if you like each other, to see if you're, you know, want to be part of the club. But Kim Jong-un...
Cocktails, light hors d'oeuvres, not sit-down dinner.
Yeah, Kim and Melania Trump is not going with.
No dates.
No, yeah. Kim Jong-un has been courted heavily. I mean, he had the Russian foreign minister over at the DMZ.
Yeah, Lavrov,
you know? Lavrov was there, and now I'm hearing President Assad is going to be meeting with him in the next few days.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone wants a little piece of Kimmy, huh?
There's barely enough to go around. But for more on the summit being back on and what, if anything, productive is possible, we're pleased to be joined by Bill Gertz, senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon and author of the book I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi. Good to be on the show.
So, you know, the gamesmanship of the summit being on, summit being off, summit being back on, notwithstanding, what are the possibilities here? I mean, is this going to be... Is there any possibility of this to be Reagan and Gorbachev at Reykjavik, or should we calibrate our sights a little bit lower?
I think the president telegraphed what was going to happen during his little chat with reporters before he headed off to Camp David on last Friday. And he basically said that they're looking at concluding the Korean War, which would be a significant step. As for denuclearization, the U.S. is holding fast to its position, which they're calling CVID, which is complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement. I don't see that happening just because of the nature of the North Korean regime, which is to keep the Kim family dynasty in power. And those nuclear weapons are the key guarantor. I don't think he's going to accept U.S. security guarantees.
Well, that's different than Trump said. Now, maybe he's just, you know, trying to project a hopeful note, saying that he thought Kim Jong-un was interested in denuclearization.
Yeah, but he was then saying, he said, well, it may not happen all at once, and then it may happen over time. And to me, that's a trap, a negotiating trap by the North Koreans to get concessions, because what happened in the lead-up to first the summit, then the summit being off and now being on again, was that the U.S. made clear that it would not provide economic aid to North Korea until after denuclearization. Kim Jong-un then went and flew to Dalian, China, and met with Xi Jinping, and the word is that he was promised economic aid from the Chinese, and that's where you had this anti-U.S. sentiment coming out after that. So the Chinese were kind of subverting the summit, and I think the president expressed his concern about that. Then it appears that he canceled the summit, and then it appears that the North Koreans blinked and said, oh, yeah, we want to have a summit. But this issue of denuclearization is obviously the key thing.
Well, why would a President Assad want to have a face-to-face meeting with Kim Jong-un?
Well, Kim's stock is high now because he's going to be – this is a little tiny half – communist country that's been accused of crimes against humanity for its human rights abuses, and he's going to meet with the most powerful leader in the democratic world, and So he's gaining a lot of credibility among the rogue regimes of the world, and that's why they're all jumping on the bandwagon to snuggle up to Kim Jong-un.
How does the trade negotiations between the U.S. and China, which have now ended without a settlement, there was some hope that there was going to get some kind of agreement to help prop up the Chinese telecom giant ZTE in exchange for lowering tariffs on American agricultural goods. That seems to be by the boards at present. Well, how does that factor into China's posture with North Korea vis-a-vis the U.S.?
Well, yeah, the Chinese are still back on their heels with the the U.S. North Korean summit. They were aced out. You know, the president made clear last year that it was up to China to deal with North Korea, and obviously they didn't. They've had a duplicitous policy of saying they support the U.S. while secretly supporting North Korea. And now the president's tightening up his trade issue with China and sent over this Wilbur Ross Commerce Department delegation and didn't get any solution. And now the Chinese are threatening trade retaliation if the U.S. goes ahead with its big tranche of tariffs on Chinese goods, which is supposed to happen this month, I guess.
And what about our steel tariffs? I mean, on our allies, we've got the EU, Mexico, Canada saying that it's a security threat. Can you explain that?
Well, the Trump administration has linked economic security with national security. And I think this reflects the president's view that, you know, that trade and business are his key strengths in terms of his experience as a businessman. So that's kind of what he's advocating. He's kind of very much made U.S. fair trade a part of U.S. national security. So he's elevated that as a key priority. I mean, the National Security Council doesn't do economics, but we have this National Economic Council and the White House people. Peter Navarro in particular is a real hawk on China. He's kind of been driving the train on these tough U.S. Trump administration posture on foreign fair trade.
Some of the president's detractors, like former CIA Director John Brennan, are suggesting that Kim Jong-un and the North Koreans are outflanking Trump. They're manipulating him. It's bad for America's national security. Is Trump engaging with Jong-un unilaterally at all? Is that folly, or is this does this have the potential to be productive, even if not everything we would like from the North Koreans, like denuclearization?
Yeah, I do have concerns that they are making too many concessions. But on the other hand, I think it's important to at least try to have a meeting and have a direct talks with this rogue state leader. And, you know, there's no harm in holding talks as long as you don't make too many concessions. And that's really the danger, as I mentioned, that the U.S. could make too many dangers. I was a bit concerned by a tweet recently by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, where he said he was basically promoting the upcoming Singapore summit as saying, yes, the United States wants to see a strong, prosperous, and secure North Korea. I don't think that should be the U.S. policy at all. I mean, again, this is a horrible regime that has committed, literally, according to the UN Commission a couple of years ago, crimes against humanity in its treatment of its own people. So I don't know if we should be advocating for a strong North Korea.
And how are our South Korean allies responding to this on-again, off-again summit? And what trepidation do they have in terms of what may come from it?
Well, the current South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, is very conciliatory towards North Korea, not as much as others of his party in the past, who have taken a very liberal approach and trying to basically an appeasement-oriented approach to try to develop closer ties with North Korea. But he has made some concessions. They've had a couple of meetings, and you know, all the talks from South Korea are, yeah, let's try and give them aid. So there is concern that the South Koreans could disrupt this maximum pressure campaign, which the president has kind of backed off of now by offering North Korea aid in the future.
Now, President Clinton, he's making all the rounds, you know, because he's pushing a book. And he was upset that President Trump smiled with the North Korean top leader that was at the White House. He said, you never smile to the North Koreans. You never give them that much power.
Well, you know, Trump is not your average politician. And, you know, he does what he thinks is the best. And there's no book on what Donald Trump will do in his dealings. You know, he comes at it from a completely different point of view. And, you know, a lot of people think that's a good thing. I mean, just obviously not the politics as usual kind of approach.
Yeah, right. I mean, the same people had no problem with Obama genuflecting before Islamic theocrats. Bill Gertz, senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon, author of the book, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And I think we've got a leading candidate to resuscitate the Naked Gun franchise, Amy, the Frank Drebin character. He is a FBI agent who was off duty at a Denver nightclub.
Yeah, and he decided to do something different, trying to impress the ladies. He was part of a breakdancing circle, and the women, they were watching him. He was noticed.
It was a breakdance circle, like quintessential breakdance circle.
Quintessential.
There was one man who was doing flips, and then he left, and the FBI agent, I guess, we didn't know that, he came on the scene, and he did a backflip. And he was dancing, and then right as he did that backflip, his gun fell out, and it hit the ground. It shot off.
Well, it didn't shoot off. He shot it off when he picked it up.
Yeah, if you watch the video in slow-mo, you can see him. He grabs it. Why would he pull the trigger while he's putting the... He was nervous or something.
That's right, what happened.
Bullet hit a man in the leg. Thank goodness he's okay.
Thank goodness he didn't return fire.
ABC tried desperately to reach the FBI for comment. They're not commenting, but the Denver Police Department is investigating on whether or not to charge him.
Tough times for the FBI. This is not going to improve their standing in the public eye, I suspect. Now, we did get some audio. The FBI is not talking, but he's talking. We got some interaction between this off-duty FBI agent and his supervisor about the incident.
Oh, Drebin, I don't want any more trouble like you had last year on the South Side. Understand? That's my policy.
Yes, well, when I see five weirdos dressed in togas stabbing a guy in the middle of the park in full view of 100 people, I shoot the bastards. That's my policy.
That was a Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar, you moron. You killed five actors. Good ones.
So after that, of course, the FBI off-duty officer, he's going to be on suspension pending a full investigation. And so he said farewell to his colleagues.
We shot a lot of people together. It's been great. But today I retire. So if I do any shooting now, it'll have to be within the confines of my own home. Hopefully it'll be an intruder and not an in-law like at my bachelor party. Blowing away a fleeing suspect with my .44 Magnum used to be everything to me. I enjoyed it. Well, who wouldn't?
Awesome. Yeah, so it's not work when you do what you love is the point.
Exactly.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.